Welcome to today's reading of Sports Today, a one-hour reading of sports news from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin today's reading with a headline that reads, Ovechkin passes Gretzky as the top NHL goal scorer. And this feature written by Mike Bream of USA Today. The Great Eight has topped the Great One. Washington Capitals star Alex Ovechkin set the NHL record for career goals when he scored number 895 on April the 6th against the New York Islanders to pass Hall of Famer Wayne Gretzky. He scored on the power play, ripping a shot by Islanders goalie Ilya Sorokin at 7:26 of the second period for the 325th power play goal of his career. Longtime teammate and fellow 2018 Stanley Cup winner Tom Wilson had the primary assist. Ovechkin slid on the ice in celebration, let out a big roar, and teammates mobbed him. Quote, I'm probably going to need a couple more days, a couple more weeks, actually, to realize what it means to be number one, he told reporters after the game. But I am proud for myself, I'm proud for my family, and for all of my teammates that helped me reach that milestone, and for all of my coaches. It's huge, unquote. Gretzky scored his final NHL goal in March of 1999 against the Islanders. Ovechkin's record breaker happened on the 45th anniversary of Gordie Howe's 801st and final goal, which stood as the record until Gretzky passed him in 1994. It also happened 21 years to the day that the Capitals won the draft lottery for the right to select Ovechkin. Play was stopped as Gretzky, NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman, Capitals owner Ted Leonsis, Ovechkin's family, and others came out on the ice for a ceremony in which Ovechkin was gifted a painting. Bettman, Gretzky, and Ovechkin spoke. Gretzky's mark of 894 goals was considered unbreakable when he retired at age 38 back in 1999. Ovechkin wouldn't be drafted until the year 2004 as the first overall pick, and he wouldn't make his debut until 2005 because of a season-long lockout. He scored twice in his NHL debut and had 52 goals that year, some of them jaw-dropping, and edged Sidney Crosby of the Pittsburgh Penguins for the Rookie of the Year award. Gretzky, a 185-pound Canadian center, was an exceptional playmaker who also scored a lot because of his ability to anticipate plays. Ovechkin, a 240-pound Russian winger, is a physical specimen. He would dole out hits, never gave up on a puck, and had a one-timer that was hard to stop. Center Nicholas Backstrom, who assisted on 279 Ovechkin goals, said that the winger has a bigger, quote-unquote, sweet spot than other players, which allowed him to get a shot off at many different angles. Sometimes it seems that the puck just finds him, Backstrom told reporters last month. He's got that ability to put the puck in the net like nobody else, unquote. Gretzky scored a record-shattering 92 goals in the 1981-82 season with the high-flying Edmonton Oilers, then followed with 71 goals, 87 goals, and 73 goals. Ovechkin's best season was 65 goals in his third season, but his consistency is what put him over the top. He led the league in goals 9 times, and this month he passed Howell's record of 415 goals after turning 30. In the beginning of last season, it looked like Ovechkin might be slipping as he scored just 9 goals through the end of January. But he scored 22 goals after vacationing during the All-Star break, making this record possible. This season, he got off to a torrid start with 15 goals in 18 games, but suffered a fractured left fibula during a November 18th game. It cost him 16 games. He has scored 27 times in 43 games since he returned on December 28th to give him 42 goals this season, third best in the league. Ovechkin, now age 39, will build on his record because he has another year left on his contract. He showed you can never call a record unbreakable, but his goal-scoring accomplishment will be hard to eclipse. They say records are made to be broken, but I don't know who's going to get more than that, Gretzky said in the on-ice ceremony. And again, that feature is entitled Ovechkin Passes Gretzky as the Top NHL Goal Scorer, written by Mike Bream of USA Today. And in a related story, this next short feature is entitled Gretzky Congratulates Ovechkin in Touching On-Ice Ceremony. This is written by Steve Gardner of USA Today. The moment Alex Ovechkin scored his record-breaking 895th goal with 7 minutes 22 seconds gone in the second period against the New York Islanders on April the 6th, play stopped and the celebration began. The great Wayne Gretzky was on hand as the Washington Capitals icon passed him on the NHL's all-time goal-scoring list. And Gretzky was front and center in the presentation ceremony. Quote, Alex, I said I'd be the first guy to shake your hand when you broke the record, unquote, Gretzky said before offering Ovechkin a handshake and a hug. When Ovechkin took the mic, he started by expressing his gratitude to everyone who played a part in him getting to 895. Quote, like I always said all the time, it's a team sport. And without my boys, the whole organization, the fans, the trainers, the coaches, I would never stand there, and obviously I would never pass the great one. So, fellas, thank you so much. I love you so much. We did it, boys. We did it. Unquote. With his mother, wife, and 2 boys with him, Ovechkin also made a point to thank his family for their support. As part of the ceremony, NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman presented Ovechkin with a commemorative painting by renowned artist Tony Harris. The 5x3-foot oil painting on canvas features an image of Ovechkin lifting the Stanley Cup after the Capitals won it in the year 2018 in the background, with another image of Ovechkin in the foreground taking one of his signature slap shots, which naturally got him his record-breaking 895th goal. And again, that feature entitled Gretzky Congratulates Ovechkin in a Touching On-Ice Ceremony by Steve Gardner of USA Today. And from hockey news, let's turn now to some baseball news. The next headline reads, Guerrero's $500 million contract means hope attainable for all. And this feature written by Gabe Lackes, columnist for USA Today. Vladimir Guerrero will be a Toronto Blue Jay for life, essentially, and agreeing to the game's second largest contract is proof that there is a dance partner for almost everyone in Major League Baseball. Vladimir Guerrero's 14-year, deferral-free $500 million extension trails only the great Juan Soto's $765 million deal in value. It stops shy of Shohei Ohtani's nice round number of $700 million, but Guerrero will see all the money before he's on the wrong side of 40. And it ends a long-running staring contest between franchise and player that intensified when the sides could not come to an agreement by the beginning of spring training. While extensions have been doled out since opening day, Guerrero's is one of one, as is he, which the Toronto Blue Jays were wise to realize. At age 26, Guerrero was bound for free agency at that magic age that equals unprecedented riches. Think Bryce Harper, Manny Machado, and yes, Juan Soto, all reaping the benefits of being teenage or 20-ish prodigies who hit the market before their ages can be used against them. At first glance, Guerrero falls just shy of those sluggers who all reset the contract bar in various meaningful fashions. He's had just one MVP-caliber season, a 2021 tour de force when he hit 48 home runs, amassed a 6.5 WAR, and only missed joining his Hall of Fame father in the MVP club because Ohtani existed. The doomsayer might note that that season was effectively canceled out by a 2023 campaign during which Guerrero's homers shrank to 26 and his OPS to 788, closer to league average than generational. But a series of related events followed that shot Guerrero into the $500 million club. First, Ohtani said thanks but no thanks to the Blue Jays' cross-continental pitch. And then MVP Vladimir returned, hitting 30 homers and pushing his OPS back up to 940, his 167 adjusted mark matching his 2021 output, paired with just 96 strikeouts, a power-hitting savant by today's standards. And when the Jays' bid for Soto resulted in another bridesmaid's bouquet and Soto resetting the global contract market, Toronto had no choice but to come to Vladimir. He handled it with the conviction and steadiness and the security that one might expect from a second-generation superstar. No, Guerrero said, he wasn't seeking Soto money. And no, the Blue Jays had not come particularly close in their offer. When Blue Jays brass responded with some actuarial pablum about shared risk and sustainability and the like, Vladimir looked like a goner. It made for great spring training drama, at the least. Yet, to both sides' credit, the dialogue continued. Vladimir held his ground. The Blue Jays realized that the cost of a superstar to build their team and media empire around wasn't about to go down. And so it got done. Its eminence first reported by Mike Rodriguez. And almost important for the industry, Vladimir won't be a Yankee or a Red Sox or a Met. Not that it would have mattered anyway, but narratives have a way of spinning out of control. And the notion that 2 to 4 coastal elite franchises control all the talent, especially now that the Red Sox have woken up, was closer to becoming gospel as the collective bargaining agreement draws nearer to its December 2026 expiration. Yet the Guerrero Pact shows that the vast majority of teams and all the players enjoy a wide range of freedom. Freedom to say no to a contract extension or re-up for life. Freedom to use some of the quote-unquote dry powder that franchises possess towards one asset that the fans know and love, or to hang on to for another day. Everyone's different, exemplified by Jackson Merrill's decision to accept a 9-year, $135 million extension from San Diego as a 21-year-old, rather than bide his time and hit free agency himself at that magic age of 26. Or the Red Sox guaranteeing Christian Campbell at least $60 million less than a week into his career, and for Campbell to take that money in the bank and accept security. Naturally, the lower revenue clubs may struggle to retain stars a little more. Yet so many have scarcely tried and come nowhere near leveraging their greatest resource to both build a fan base and buttress their franchise value. If you're scoring at home, the Paul Skeens doomsday clock in Pittsburgh has not quite 5 years remaining. But deadlines can be fake. Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association will prove that many times during their pre- and post-lockout posturing. So, too, was Vladimir Guerrero's spring training line in the sand. Turns out that there was will and a way, and Blue Jays fans will be better off for it. And again, that feature is entitled Vladimir Guerrero's $500 million contract means hope is attainable for all, written by Gabe Lackes, columnist for USA Today. And the next baseball feature is entitled Splashing Cash, Red Sox Future is Now. This feature also written by Gabe Lackes, columnist for USA Today, Dateline Baltimore. Garrett Crochet has barely started enough games in his career to comprise an entire major league season, still has the youthful sheen of a 25-year-old, and yet has toted the mental weight of a much older player. From the college diamond in Knoxville to the 11th pick in the draft to a lightning-quick debut, a trip to the operating table for a new elbow ligament, a hopeless situation with Major League Baseball's worst team, and finally a trade that united his elite stuff with a team that could do something with it, Crochet has seen some things in his baseball career. So when he took the mound the night of April the 2nd at Camden Yards, barely a day after agreeing to a 6-year, $170 million contract extension with the Boston Red Sox, Crochet enjoyed a freedom so unfamiliar that he could not place the most recent time he felt it. Quote, "I can't think of the last time I played baseball for pride," Crochet said after dominating a very good Baltimore Orioles lineup in a 3-0 conquest, his first win as a Red Sox. Quote, "In college, you're playing to get drafted. Once you're in the big leagues, you're playing to stay in the big leagues. To have the security and feel like I'm playing to truly just win ball games, it takes a lot of the riffraff out of it," unquote. Suddenly, the skies on the horizon are looking very bright for Crochet and for the Red Sox. They had won 6 of their first 10 games, with 2 wins started by Crochet, and the events of his recent past further cemented the Red Sox' newfound aggression of playing both for the now and the future, of procuring good players, putting their faith in them, and then rewarding them with long-term security. First, Crochet. With nearly 2 full years before free agency, the Red Sox and his representatives agreed on a 6-year, $170 million extension last week, with a chance to opt out after the 2030 season. Then, second baseman Christian Campbell. He had been a major leaguer for just 6 games, but on April the 2nd agreed to an 8-year, $60 million contract that gives him some cash right up front and ties him to Boston through at least the year 2032 with two club options that can raise the value to $96 million. All that comes on the heels of the bold trade that landed Crochet from the 121-loss Chicago White Sox, followed by the early spring signing of Alex Bregman to a 3-year, $120 million deal. The quick strikes come after a 5-year span that roughly began with the unthinkable trade of Mookie Betts and flattened out after the past 3 years produced two 78-win, 84-loss seasons and last year's 81-81 campaign. All the while, they lost championship stalwarts like Xander Bogaerts and Nathan Eovaldi and became an utter non-destination, never really in the running for Japanese stars like Yoshinobu Yamamoto and Roki Sasaki, and just courtesy players in the big-time Juan Soto sweepstakes. And now? Well, they're not quite the Red Sox who won 3 championships in 10 years from 2004 to 2013 while sporting a payroll that typically ran second only to the Yankees. But the days of trying to cobble a playoff winner out of a 26-man aggregate of mediocrity are over, with general manager Craig Breslow committed to deploying the young talent his predecessor, Shane Bloom, accrued while supplementing aggressively in the trade and the free agent markets. Quote, "It's important. It's huge," says Red Sox manager Alex Cora, who led the club to a 2018 World Series title but had just one playoff squad in the years since. "I told our GM, Breslow, congratulations, because it is not easy. It takes two to tango, right? We've been able to secure some guys in this organization now that are going to be huge for us. It's a good business decision, a good business model, too. Hopefully, we can continue that and secure more players," unquote. But the biggest get is already in place. At 6'6" and 245 pounds, there's really only one figure that Crochet can cut on a mound. He is freaking intimidating. That elite extension on the mound that produces a 97-mile-per-hour fastball and a deceptive delivery prompted the White Sox to draft him 11th overall in the year 2020 and bring him to the majors as a reliever a few months later in that pandemic-shortened season. But Tommy John surgery would soon follow, wiping out his 2022 season. And when he came back, he was still dabbling in the bullpen, while the White Sox threw him in the rotation to start the 2024 season. Wise move. Crochet made the All-Star game and was a walking trade rumor thereafter, Chicago eventually pulling him off the market since suitors were not exactly sure what he could offer down the stretch in his first full year as a starter. Yet, Crochet was the biggest trade prize of the winter, and Boston paid a premium to get him, with a package centered on elite catching prospect Kyle Teal and recent first-round pick Braden Montgomery. They would have Crochet for 2 seasons, but with one major surgery behind him and a desire to stay in Boston, team and player sniffed each other out for most of the spring. A comfort level was achieved. An opening day deadline to land an extension was set. The sides were close. As Crochet readied for his second consecutive opening day start, and first as a Red Sox, there was a growing sensation the sides might reach an accord. It was a done deal by Crochet's second turn through the rotation. There was really good dialogue leading up to opening day, which made us feel pushing past the deadline was the right call, says Crochet. Becoming comfortable in a new organization is something that doesn't come naturally. Once we got over to Fort Myers in spring training, I think it really did. It came very organically and something that me and my wife were really excited for, unquote. In Crochet's first start as a University of Tennessee freshman, he pitched 8 innings. He hadn't seen the 8th inning as a starter since, at least until April the 2nd. That's when Crochet subdued the Baltimore Orioles so thoroughly, Cora went against his usual early season instincts and let Crochet pitch the 8th inning after needing only 82 pitches to get through the first 7 innings. And he would need just 10 pitches to finish his masterpiece. 8 innings, 4 hits, 8 strikeouts, and 1 walk, retiring 11 in a row at that point. This was like nothing Boston had seen since Chris Sale pitched the Red Sox to the 2018 World Series title. Quote, "It's electric. It's on the attack always," says shortstop Trevor Story of the view from his infield perch. "Even the way he comes out on the mound, he's a big boy and he's coming right at you," unquote. It was the greatest game on Crochet's resume, a sample size that is small yet portends devastation for future opponents. In 34 career starts, beginning with 2024's opening day, he has 221 strikeouts to just 36 walks, a 3.40 ERA, and nearly 13 strikeouts per 9 innings. He did not pitch to his expectations in the 2025 opener at Texas. Last week's start was different. Quote, "It wasn't so much the contract as much as my first one not going the way I wanted," he says. "I felt like I was pitching on my heels. Today was more of a statement to myself. Who do I want to be this year? Who am I as a pitcher and a person? Someone who could be in the zone and win or lose with their best stuff," unquote. Meanwhile, the Red Sox are gathering forces around him. Like Crochet, Campbell's agents were making progress on a long-term extension during the club's trip to Texas. Yet this was so different. Christian Campbell, age 22, spent his spring training simply hoping to make the team and was less than 2 years removed from getting drafted in the 4th round out of Georgia Tech. Yet he has so impressed the Red Sox both in skill level and his uncanny ability to improve that it basically went like this. "You are our second baseman. How about you stick around for the next decade?" "It means a lot. They developed me from day one," Campbell said a couple of hours after the contract was finalized. Quote, "As soon as I got drafted, they've been working with me every day. I've learned something new every day. They've helped me become the player I am today. So it means a lot to me that I'm with the Red Sox for a long time. It definitely is crazy, but it's amazing. My family is very excited. They developed me. They put their trust in me," unquote. Yet Campbell gave them plenty of reasons for that faith. Training with the Red Sox hitting group has increased his maximum exit velocity from 106 miles an hour at Georgia Tech to 113 miles an hour. Diligent training with weighted bats cranked his bat speed up to an average of 74.4 miles per hour in the 85th percentile of all major leaguers in this early part of the year. The results have matched the metrics. He has 4 multi-hit games in 10 games played and has 12 hits overall. Meanwhile, he's drawn rave reviews from Red Sox veterans and Cora for his work at second base, showing off-the-chart growth across spring training, which began with him on the backfields with Cora, the old middle infielder, showing the kid how to move around the second base bag. Quote, "Think about everything that was going on, trying to make a team, and then all this contract stuff happened," says Cora. "It's not easy. His teammates, he calls them friends, actually, have helped him to slow it down, and we're very happy that he's going to be a part of this," unquote. A visual learner, Cora calls Campbell. A burgeoning baseball genius, his teammates say. Quote, "He does so many things really well on the baseball field," says Bregman, who can opt out of his contract after this season. Quote, "He's only going to get better. Obviously, he is young, but he has a very advanced knowledge of the strike zone and swings at good pitches to hit. And he hits the ball really hard. He's continuing to get better ever since the first day I've seen him. From talking to people around the organization, that's the way it's been since he's gotten here," unquote. And says Story, "It feels like he doubles every time." Campbell is part of the Red Sox Big Four of prospects, with Teal used as crochet trade bait. Outfielder Roman Anthony expected to be the best of the bunch, and shortstop Marcelo Meyer lurking should any injuries befall the infield. Yet it's the overall organizational commitment that portends particularly good things. Perhaps Crochet will be remembered as the Pied Piper of a Boston Renaissance. It was his acquisition that signaled the Red Sox meant business. Then they showed Bregman the money when he festered on the free agent market and very well could try re-upping him on a longer term come winter. And now, certainly with Crochet. "We're in a good spot," says Cora. "When you start getting deals like this, it means a lot, not only for the players, but the fan base, right? Along with potential acquisitions down the road. It shows again how willing ownership is to try and win. So it's exciting," says Bregman. "You want to be in an organization that wants to win. And they've proven that, obviously, this offseason and now early in the season as well. Now it's up to us to go and win some games," unquote. Every fifth day, their odds should be outstanding. "That's the reason that he's here. And that's the reason that we committed to him," Cora says of Crochet. "He's a big guy. He has a presence out there. But he knows how to pitch," unquote. And again, that baseball feature is entitled Splashing Cash, Boston Red Sox Future is Now, written by Gabe Lackus, columnist for USA Today. And from baseball news, let's turn now to some college basketball news. The next feature is entitled Duke Deals with Fallout of Epic Meltdown. This feature, written by Paul Meyerberg of USA Today, Dateline San Antonio. The lead was 9 points with 2 minutes, 15 seconds remaining. And even as Duke struggled to convert on the offensive end, there was no thought given to the idea that the Blue Devils might actually lose to Houston in this battle of number one seeds in the men's national semifinal at the Final Four. The lead was down to 7 points with a minute 26 to play, to 6 points at the 42-second mark. Again, the very idea that the Blue Devils' season would end before the national championship game was ridiculous, ludicrous, preposterous. But it is called March Madness for a reason. Trailing 64-55, Houston outscored Duke 15-3 over the final 2+ minutes to reach a finals matchup against Florida. no team had ever given away so much in so little time on college basketball's biggest stage. Quote, you go from some of the most special moments in the tournament to the most heartbreaking loss, unquote, Duke coach John Shayer said. It's heartbreaking. It's incredibly disappointing. There's a lot of pain that comes with this. That's what the tournament's all about. You're an inch away from the national championship game, unquote. Given the stakes, the names involved, and the seemingly unavoidable Duke win, what unfolded over these final 135 seconds might be the most stunning stretch in Final Four history. How it is seen depends on the point of view. To Duke, it's an epic meltdown without precedent in program history. To Houston, it's a classic comeback that helps erase generations of Final Four failures. At some point, if you have a culture, quitting is not part of the deal, said Houston coach Kelvin Sampson. We're not going to quit. We're just going to play better, unquote. What happened is easily definable. The Blue Devils were in control, and then they weren't. The Cougars hammered away, pelting Duke with body blow after body blow, and put themselves in position to deliver a stunning knockout punch. Duke gave it away, and Houston took it away. Both are simultaneously true. How it happened, on the other hand, is harder to explain, probably because this late reversal of fortune utterly defies explanation. National championship caliber teams are not supposed to cough up 9-point leads in the final minute plus, nor give up the 14-point lead that Duke held with 8 minutes 17 seconds to play. This Duke team in particular was seen as the favorite to win the program's 6th national championship. How could the Blue Devils lose? Multiple factors contributed to the second largest second half comeback in Final Four history, trailing Loyola Chicago's rally from 15 points down with 14 minutes remaining to beat Cincinnati in overtime in the 1963 championship game. One was Duke's willingness to step off the gas. After Houston cut the lead to 44-38 on a second-chance dunk with 15 minutes 37 seconds to play, the Blue Devils responded with a 15-7 run over the next 7 minutes. Momentum was in their corner. Duke allowed Houston to climb back into the mix with a three-pointer and a technical foul on senior Mason Gillis, giving the Cougars a four-point swing in a four-second span that changed the complexion of the final 8 minutes. As long as there's time on the clock, we're going out there and giving it our all, said guard L.J. Cryer, who scored a team-high 26 points. Another was the Cougars' willingness to unwaveringly stick to their style, calmly pulling closer and closer without sacrificing the approach that has turned the program into one of the marquee models of consistency on the Power 5 level. There's no greater example of Houston's unflappable self-confidence than the decision not to foul Duke after guard Emmanuel Sharp's three-pointer made the score 67-64 with 33 seconds left. Instead, the Cougars forced Duke's Sion James into a turnover, and forward Joseph Tugler slammed down Milik Wilson's miss from the right wing to draw within a point at 67-66 with 25 seconds to play. Quote, I think that was a big choice that we had to make there down the stretch, Sampson said of the decision to not send the Blue Devils to the foul line. Houston would foul guard Tyrese Proctor on Duke's ensuing possession, sending the junior to the stripe with 20 seconds left. but Proctor missed the front end of a one-on-one. And while leaping for the rebound, freshman forward Cooper Flagg was called for going over the back of Houston forward Jawan Roberts. A sixth-year senior, Roberts made both free throws to give the Cougars their first lead since going ahead 6-5 with 15 minutes and 25 seconds remaining in the first half. That Houston was by far the more disciplined team across the game's final 8 minutes underscores the Blue Devils' fatal flaw and the game's deciding factor. Duke's freshman-driven roster was the driving force to the Final Four, but wobbled in the face of the Cougars' veteran-driven steadiness. Quote, "Got to give them credit for what they do every single night they play," said Cooper Flagg, who finished with 27 points, 7 rebounds, and 4 assists in what is widely expected to be the final game of his college career. Quote, "We could have been a little bit more sharp down the stretch executing some things. At the end of the day, you got to give them a lot of credit as well," unquote. Duke guard Con Knoppel scored 16 points, but only 4 in the second half. Center Common Maluk finished with 6 points and had no rebounds across 21 foul-plagued minutes. Cooper Flagg was far more productive than he was in a lackluster performance against Alabama in the Elite Eight, but missed the potential go-ahead jumper from just inside the free throw line with 8 seconds left. "Being young, to be this successful, part of them doesn't know any better," Shire said. "Them also, like, these are the things that experience gives you when you go through these moments," unquote. This has been a season-long issue that finally brought Duke down at the doorstep of the program's 6th national championship. The Blue Devils came into Saturday having lost 3 times all season, and in each loss had the chance to tie or take the lead in the final seconds. Flagg committed a turnover in a 77-72 loss to Kentucky, and Knoppel committed a turnover in the 75-72 loss to Kansas, and Flagg turned it over in a 77-71 loss to Clemson. But Duke had lost only 3 times after all, and lost just once since November. Beating Houston and reaching the championship game seemed like a foregone conclusion before tip-off, and became only more certain as the Blue Devils stacked together the double-digit lead. And then they lost. Somehow, some way, they lost. Houston won. Rather than being canonized among the great teams in program history, and maybe the best team in history to be led primarily by freshmen, this Duke team will be defined by an epic collapse. "I'm not there yet, to be honest. I'm heartbroken for our team that did everything for 38 minutes or 39 minutes and came up short," Coach Shayer said. "Obviously, as a coach, I'm reflecting right now on what else I could have said or could have done. I'm sure there's a lot more that I could have done to help our guys at the end there. That's the thing that kills me the most," unquote. And again, that feature entitled "Duke Deals with the Fallout of an Epic Meltdown," written by Paul Meyerberg of USA Today. And from men's basketball, let's turn to some women's basketball. Headline reads, "Team Title, A Fitting End for Bukers." This feature written by Nancy Armour, columnist for USA Today, Dateline Tampa, Florida. Paige Bukers has always been a reluctant superstar. She relishes the spotlight that her transcendent talent brings only for what it allows her to do, celebrate her teammates. lift up the women who've come before her, particularly the black women who have paved the way for the opportunities that she has. That history makes how she finally got a national title so fitting. The 82-59 rout of defending champion South Carolina was not a Paige Buchers showcase game like when she dropped 40 points on Oklahoma in the Sweet 16. She finished with 17 points, 7 of which came at the free throw line, and went more than 20 minutes without making a field goal. No, this was a collective effort by UConn, her teammates able to stand tall in part because Buchers has spent so many years lifting them up. Azzie Fudd, who barely played in the title game 3 years ago because she had food poisoning, had 13 of her 24 points in the first half to set the tone. Freshman Sarah Strong let the entire country know that UConn, with the women's game overall, is going to be just fine in the post-Caitlin Clark and Buchers era. The freshman had another double-double with 24 points and 15 rebounds, as well as a team-high 5 assists, 3 blocks, and 2 steals. Quote, "All of our mindset was just to be aggressive, stay locked in, stay disciplined, stay together. And that's exactly what we did," Fudd said. "To be able to do this for our seniors, I really don't have words to describe what this feels like and what it means to me. But I'm super grateful and I'm super proud of this entire team," unquote. Caitlin Chen had 4 points. K.K. Arnold took 3 shots and made each one of them, finishing with 9 points. Ashlyn Shade's only field goal was from a 3-pointer in the corner after Buchers beat coverage by kicking the ball out to her. On down the line it went. In her final game with UConn on her front, every one of Buchers' teammates had her back. Quote, "We talked about it as a team that leading up to this weekend, we hadn't played our best team basketball yet," Buchers said. "But we thought that we were saving our best performances for last. And it's just been a great summary of what we have been this entire season, of being a team, staying connected. On any given night, it can be anybody's night. So it's extremely fitting. It's destiny. Obviously, I have a great faith, so I believe God planned it perfectly in the way that it went out," unquote. Buchers hasn't just been one of the best individual players in UConn's storied history. She is one of its most beloved. As talented as she is, she could be a prima donna and get away with it. But she wouldn't know how to do that if she tried. In this, her final season at UConn, she spent a month waking before dawn to make breakfast for teammate Yana El Afi, who was fasting during Ramadan. When she was given the mic during the post-game celebration last Sunday, the first thing she did was thank the team managers and practice players who had come to Tampa for the game. Her teammates have also seen her struggles, missing most of her sophomore year with a knee injury and all of her junior year with a torn ACL, only to come back stronger. Buchers is, as they say, a real one, and the affection her teammates have for her is obvious. When she scored on a layup with 7 minutes 45 seconds to play, getting knocked to the ground in the process and drawing a foul, her teammates dogpiled on top of her. When she left the game for good with 1:32 to play, she shared a long hug with Coach Gino Auriemma, her shoulders shaking as she sobbed in his arms. She then made her way down the bench, embracing the assistant coaches and her teammates. just gratitude for all that Coach has meant to me and how much he has shaped me to the human that I am, to the basketball player that I am throughout this entire 5 years. And just putting it all together in one big hug, what our journey has been together, Buechers said. Every single person that I went down the line and hugged just meant so much to me and meant so much to the team. Just like I've been saying, a state of gratitude, unquote. This is UConn's record 12th national title, but its first since the year 2016. That's an unheard-of drought at UConn, but it wasn't for lack of trying. Buechers took the Huskies to the Final Four every year she played and reached the title game in 2022, in her hometown of Minneapolis, of all places. But no one player can win a title on her own, even Buechers. The Huskies didn't have enough experience her freshman year, and they were done in by injuries and Fudd's illness in 2022. Last year, it's a wonder that UConn even made it to the Final Four, held together by bubblegum and sticky tape. This year, however, UConn had Buechers and Fudd and Strong and Chen and Elafi and. It always seemed like if we ever got a chance to get healthy, this could be pretty good, Coach Ariyama said. Everywhere you looked on Sunday, someone was making a play for UConn. South Carolina might have limited Buecher offensively, but they couldn't stop a multi-headed monster that was playing not just to win a title, but to win it for Buechers. They're good. They work well together. Super unselfish, South Carolina coach Don Staley said. That right there, that's going to be Buechers' legacy at UConn. Yes, she won a title, the only quote-unquote hole left in her illustrious resume that includes being the first freshman ever to win National Player of the Year honors and three unanimous selections as a first-team All-American. But that title came because Buechers is as good a teammate as she is an individual player. She made everyone around her better, and in turn, her teammates made her a champion. There is no more fitting send-off. And again, that feature entitled Team Title, A Fitting End for Buechers, written by Nancy Armour, columnist for USA Today. And in one more feature, this one's entitled Don't Ever Doubt These Huskies Legends. This feature written by Blake Topmeyer, columnist for USA Today. Paige Buechers and Gino Auriemma didn't have to prove anything to anyone last Sunday. Their talents and their splendor at UConn were not up for debate. These two are legendary. The thing about these two legends, though, they just can't stop proving their greatness. Not even mighty South Carolina could interfere with the reality this NCAA title belonged to UConn, the last great dynasty before Dawn Staley's Gamecocks ascended. UConn rules women's basketball once again after a dominant NCAA tournament run through which the Huskies showed that they possessed the game's brightest star, wisest coach, and most complete team. Buechers will always be the one who brought UConn back to the summit, and she will always say that she received so much help getting the Huskies there. Both will be true. Quote, "It takes a village to do what we do here," Buechers told ABC after the buzzer sounded on the Huskies' 12th national championship, an 82-59 rout of South Carolina. Unlike some of Auriemma's past national championships, this result could not be considered a foregone conclusion. 2 months before the confetti fell on these Huskies. They listened to Rocky Top blare at the end of a loss on February 6th at Tennessee. Bucher struggled with her shot that night, and she lacked the necessary support to fend off the hungry Lady Vols. UConn exited Knoxville with its third loss, all to good teams, sure, but the type of opponents the Huskies would need to win the national title. Then the switch flipped. As Uriema puts it, his players decided after that loss to Tennessee that they didn't just like each other, they loved each other. 10 days after the Huskies lost to Tennessee, they smashed South Carolina, evidence that they could not only hang with the elite, they could beat them. I've just never been happier than I have been in the past couple of months coaching a team, Uriema said. And again, that short feature entitled Don't Ever Doubt These Huskies Legends by Blake Topmeyer, columnist for USA Today. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Today. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a great evening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.